Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Shell wins a landmark appeal. A Dutch court finds it cannot be forced to reduce carbon emissions. It's a blow to environmentalists, but it's also an acknowledgement of the challenges of statutory limits. Also, as COP29 continues in Baku, we hear about the impact of climate change on the wine industry. New public holidays announced in China and Thailand. So, will they help domestic tourism?
It's going to help us Thai people. We want to increase the day that they stay with us instead of just 1 or 2 days, so they can increase 4 or 5 days. That would be a help.
And the downfall of 23andMe, where the struggling genealogy and DNA giant went wrong. Don't forget you can contact us about all this and whatever else on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. +44 330 678 3033. That's +44 330 678 3033. Now, just as the leaders of efforts to combat climate change are gathered in Baku for COP29, a landmark case in the Netherlands has decided one of the world's biggest oil companies does not have to comply with commitments to reduce its emissions. Previously, a court had said Shell did have to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 45%. The appeals court said the firm did have obligations based on people's right to protection against dangerous climate change, but it said Shell was already taking remedial steps. One of the groups that brought the case, Friends of the Earth, said the verdict hurt. In an emotional statement, its director, Donald Pols, said the fight was not over.
The strijd tegen gevaarlijke klimaatverandering is een marathon.
The fight against dangerous climate change is a marathon, not a sprint. And the race has only just begun. Shell is and remains one of the world's biggest polluters and must take responsibility for solving the climate problem.
Donald Pols there. Well, our correspondent Anna Holligan is in The Hague and joins me now. Anna, thanks for being with us. First of all, just walk us through this judgment. Is it saying that Shell doesn't have obligations at all?
Does it mean business as usual for Shell? Well, it depends on your interpretation. So initially, this case was brought by Friends of the Earth saying that Shell should reduce its global carbon emissions by 45% by 2030 compared to 2019 levels. District Court in The Hague said yes. Appeals Court has overturned that verdict. So the court today emphasized that protection from climate change is a human right and that companies like Shell also have a duty to protect human rights. However, the court said that forcing Shell to cut its emissions won't mitigate the global problem. It acknowledged, as you say, that Shell was already working to reduce its CO2 emissions. And the court couldn't impose a definitive percentage. So it all came down to those numbers in the end, as there was no current accepted agreement in climate science on the actual specific amount. So in terms of whether this is a green light to kind of continue business as usual, it depends on your interpretation. Judges found that Shell does have a responsibility to reduce its emissions to limit dangerous climate change, because it says the companies that are doing the most polluting also have the most responsibility to tackle climate change. So there is a kind of responsibility there, but the court itself can't impose a percentage or compel Shell to comply.
Now, Anna, we heard just now from Donald Pols, Friends of the Earth, said the fight wasn't over. So this goes to another appeal, does it?
Well, I've been asking Friends all day whether they've made a decision on that, actually. They say their lawyers are still going through this landmark ruling to decide whether or not to appeal. If they decide to appeal, it will go to the Supreme Court here in the Netherlands, and then it could be a year or so before there is a final verdict. It's also worth looking at some of the other things that Shell says, the judges said, especially in the context of business. So the appeals judges said that Shell's nearly 800 new oil and gas fields are contrary to the goals in the Paris Climate Agreement. The Court of Appeal also pointed to the European due diligence legislation, which holds large polluters like Shell responsible for drawing up a climate plan and reducing their emissions in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. We should also say that the timing is purely coincidental with COP going on, and that Shell has responded positively and says it is working to reduce its emissions by 2050, aims to become a net zero emissions company by 2050. Friends of the Earth say at least we're talking about this again.
Well, indeed. And it's an aim, I suppose, rather than a commitment, which is rather what the case was about. Anna, thanks for being with us there. So how far are big fossil fuel companies coming up to their commitments on emissions reductions generally? Well, I asked Rachel Whittaker, head of sustainable investment at the asset manager Robeco, what is the significance, first of all, of this judgment?
I think it's really important to remember that the court today confirmed that such companies do still have an obligation to limit their carbon emissions. But in our opinion, this kind of ruling really emphasizes the need for investors like us to continue with our engagement to encourage the transition of all of these kinds of companies, all the companies we invest in, towards net zero.
But I suppose a cynic would say, well, it's all very well having an aim that in general they should be cutting down. But what this case considered was whether there should actually be a specific amount that they should do. And unless companies have those kind of very specific targets, or more than targets, commitments, nothing's going to happen.
Well, I've worked in this space now for about 17 years. And over that time, we've seen an enormous transformation in how transparent businesses are towards investors and towards all other stakeholders on the impact of environmental and social issues on their business. And of course, the impact of their business on environment and society. So we've seen transparency increase. And then in recent years, we've seen that pressure start to shift from simply being transparent to actually making forward-looking commitments. And we're starting to see regulation and also initiatives like the Science-Based Targets Initiative growing up to help companies and financial institutions set quantitative emissions reductions targets, you know, in line with the latest climate science. But of course, setting a target is easy, and then actually taking action and implementing that and achieving it is very difficult.
I was going to say, how close have they come in these circumstances? Are they actually approaching these targets in real terms?
In some cases, and it depends on the topic, because it's not only around climate action that we've seen targets being set. We've also seen it in areas like diversity. But companies face a bit of a dilemma. If they set a quantitative target and then they fail to meet it despite their best efforts, they could potentially face a backlash or criticism, even if they've actually moved in the right direction. And what we don't want to do is discourage companies from setting clear targets and try to move towards them. So we have to find a balance between making sure that any kind of commitments that companies make are credible and not creating a disincentive if they're unable to achieve them in the end.
But if companies, if their feet are held to the fire by, for example, a legal requirement to do these kind of things, most people would say, well, that's the best encouragement there can be, because otherwise, you know, they just play to their shareholders who want to see a good return and not much else.
We have seen that a lot of the incoming regulation is really focused on promoting accountability and not simply on disclosing information just for the sake of it, but really focusing on key issues. If companies are managing them, that they can use that internally, they can demonstrate their commitment to sustainability and move towards achieving them. But we also recognize that it costs money and effort to do that. And where we see the most significant gains in terms of sustainability tends to be during periods of relative economic stability. And I think it's fair to say that at the moment, there's a lot of uncertainty in the global economy. So it's possible that in the short term, we will see some areas of sustainability start to fall down the agenda of priorities of some companies. But we're very much on a long-term trajectory towards more sustainable companies, towards more transparency and more commitments. Despite, you know, there being ups and downs on the way there, I still believe that we are heading in the right direction.
Rachel Whittaker at Robeco. Well, as the COP meeting has noted, the UN's World Meteorological Organization says 2024 is on track to be the world's warmest year on record. An increase in the number and severity of extreme weather events, from bushfires to flash floods, are having an impact on the production of food and drink. Daniel Rosny has been taking a look at how it's affecting the wine sector.
When you think about wine-producing countries, the UK may not spring to mind. But figures from industry association Wine GB show that there are now more than 1,000 vineyards which produced more than 21 million bottles last year. That was up almost 80% from the year before. But that growth isn't guaranteed to continue.
It's not been a great year.
Nick Wayman owns Albury Vineyard in Surrey, England.
We've had a pretty poor summer. Lots and lots of rain, which has caused some disease on the vineyard.
The harvest was later than other years for Nick and his team, and there's no guarantee the grapes are good enough to be used for wine.
We've had as much as 38 tonnes in 2018 and as little as 3 tonnes in 2021 when we were completely overtaken with downy mildew. I think the general sort of view is that we're going to get more good years going forward, but we're going to get more bad years as well.
With extreme weather as a result of climate change becoming more unpredictable, it's getting harder for businesses to weather the storm. Now the industry is coming together globally to learn how to adapt. Catherine Le Parmentier is Managing Director of Great Wine Capitals.
In Bordeaux in particular, it's been a tough year. We've had frozen in May, which is terrible because all the flowers are already out. So when it freezes, it's really bad. Then we had hail episodes early summer when the grapes now are out.
Catherine set up Great Wine Capitals 25 years ago. It's a global network of wine regions from countries like Argentina, South Africa, the US and New Zealand.
One of the very important things that we share in terms of crisis. Almost 3 years ago now, there were these bushfires destroying the whole South Australian vineyards and region, right? The fires were not even down that they connected with Napa. Napa Valley is also undergoing these huge fires.
But there's a growing need in the wine sector for preventative measures rather than a post-mortem. That's where global consultancy Vinescapes says it can help. Its founder is Alistair Nesbitt.
We go in and we help to try and build resilience into their businesses. Everything we do is driven really by sort of science, and for some businesses, it's much longer term. The change is happening so quick in terms of climate. Brands are having to adapt and they're having to become flexible.
But while the industry is looking for solutions, critics in traditional wine-growing parts of the world argue that red tape is preventing producers from making changes. Here's Armando Corsi, an associate professor of wine business in Adelaide.
We have been planting lately a lot more of, for example, Italian grape varieties. Because of their adaptability to the Australian climate, unlike Europe, where if you are linked with a specific protected designation of origin, a specific code of production, there is no way that you can plant whatever you want.
On the Greek island of Santorini, in a region long known for its wines, some estimates suggest grape production is less than half of what it was 20 years ago.
My name is Yanis Valambos, and I'm the founder of Vasaltis Vineyards. Since 2019, it became apparent that we have to kind of evolve our cultivation techniques. Here, we're not talking about irrigation that will increase the yields. We're talking about irrigation that will help the plant survive.
And hopefully for the business to survive too. A report in the Nature Reviews Earth and Environment Journal suggests around 70% of wine regions could be lost if the planet warms to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So projections that temperatures will hit a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in 2024 could be hard for winemakers to swallow.
Daniel Rosny reporting. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's have a look at what's been going on the share markets and economics generally across the world. Let's talk to Fiona Cincotta, Senior Market Analyst at City Index. Fiona, thanks for being with us.
Hi there.
Hi. So one of the interesting things I think that will catch the eye, and perhaps catch in the throats of some, is US banks are expecting to pay heftier bonuses this Christmas for the first time, actually, since 2021.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, if we just think back to bank earnings, which we had just a couple of weeks ago, the US banks performed particularly well. They benefited from a recovery in deal making, from the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates, and also equity markets surging. So not only that, they're also optimistic about the outlook for 2025, which means that there's a bigger pot and they're willing to be more generous with their bonuses, which are expected to come in high, but just lower, just slightly lower than 2021's level.
Interesting to see how that plays and what people make of it. I imagine there will be some controversy. Let's turn our thoughts to India. Now, this is interesting. We've been talking a lot about inflation. You and I have often spoken about the problems across many different countries. But India's inflation now seems to be higher than expected, 6.1%. That seems like a lot right now.
Yeah, so it's really jumped up recently. I mean, it's at a 14-month high. So it rose from 5.49% in September. It came in ahead of expectations. And basically behind this is we're seeing a real big increase in food inflation in the country. So vegetable prices are a particular source of this inflation. Food inflation is up over 10%. And basically this is dashing hopes and expectations of a rate cut from the RBI anytime soon. The RBI's target level is 2% to 6% for inflation. And yeah, so at 6.2%, it's above the level that they'll be looking for.
Not a joy then for anyone borrowing money in India at the moment. Let's talk about some companies specifically. Now, Nissan, this has been interesting, Fiona. Their shares jumped 21%. Now, it seems to be down to an activist investor. What's going on?
Yes, that's right. So we've had basically a jump in shares, 20%, after a fund managed by active investor Efficissimo Capital Management. I hope I got my my pronunciation correct there. That basically sent the share price higher. He's basically revealed to have taken a stake in the struggling Japanese car maker. And the hope is here that basically their activist approach to their assets will spark some sort of revival in Nissan, which has been under pressure in recent months.
And very briefly and finally, Tencent Music. Now, they've been very much in the gambling vein, and they've missed estimates for their quarterly revenue because China, it seems, clamping down on all this quite a lot.
Yeah, that's right. So we've seen Tencent Music, their net share price down 6%. Basically, they missed on earnings and revenue. I mean, we did see some encouraging numbers from their core music subscription, which was up 20%. But as you said, that entertainment center that you were talking about, that was down 23%, the revenue there. So disappointing numbers.
Thanks for being with us once again, Fiona. Fiona Singh-Cotta there of City Index. Well, staying with China, if you live in China, or indeed in Thailand, you have got some reason for celebration because you've got more national holidays to look forward to. China is going to add two extra days to its annual public holidays, starting in 2025. Lunar New Year's Eve, which falls on January the 28th, and May the 2nd. In Thailand, the government's also announced extra public holidays, three of them, next year to support their Amazing Thailand Grand Tourism and Sports Year initiative. The push in all this is to get domestic or internal tourism, people holidaying in their own country, to boost the income from it. Although, of course, the extra time off also could take money out of the economy. So how happy will Thais be about their new holidays? Here's Pitak.
My feelings about the cabinet resolution to add additional holidays in New Year is that I'm very happy. I'll be using these holidays to travel and do some activities with my family. It's my time to relax and be ready for the next year.
Hi, my name is Rinti Renuwat. I am a freelance journalist based in Bangkok. The additional holiday that the Thai cabinet approved today doesn't affect me at all because I work as a freelance. I can take holiday anytime that I want. But it'd be great for the people who work 9-to-5 jobs or those with spending power. They can travel more or they can go back to their hometowns, visit their loved ones. And their traveling costs, the food that they buy, the gift that they give to their loved one during the holiday will actually generate money back to the Thai economy. So it will help Thailand.
So a bit of a mixed view on that. But what about the holiday industry? Well, Nippon Siddikanakul runs a small resort on Koh Mak. That's an island off Thailand's east coast. I asked him if it would help his business.
Certainly, yes, because this is going to focus to the Thai traveler coming to outside Bangkok. The place like Koh Mak is 5 to 6 hour drive and also to take another 1 hour by the boat. So that means it could take the whole day to travel. So that means that people will need at least 2 or 3 days for the vacation. So this is going to help. So this is going to start from the high season. But for Thai people, they're going to come after this. That means from March onward.
So that will help a lot because in your low time, you'll get more Thai people.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And we expect for Thai people to stay longer because we don't want them to just come and stay for 1 or 2 days on their holiday.
Do you think Thai people, when they go on holiday, do they want to go on holiday in Thailand or do they want to go to China or Singapore?
I think depends on the economy. Middle income people, they prefer Japan, China, or even Singapore. But for a little bit of concern of economy, they would travel within the country.
So do you think more Thai people now are holidaying in Thailand than they used to?
I think so, because with these people concerned more on their economy, so they're mostly traveling within domestic. You're going to see more increasing for the middle income to the high income people going abroad, but mainly it's going to be to Asia.
So it will be good for you, for your hotel. You expect having more holidays will help.
Yeah, it's going to help us Thai people. We want to increase the day that they stay with us. I mean, instead of just 1 or 2 days, so they can increase 4 or 5 days. That would be help for us.
Nippon Sudikanakul. But what about China? Well, Wei Wu is with the Easy Tour China travel company in Guilin in the south of the country. I asked him if new holidays would help Chinese tourist businesses.
Yes, I think so. In addition to the travel company I work in, we also invested in a guest house in the countryside. That could potentially give the countryside guest house another full day of business.
Because people in China, ordinary people,
yes,
will just think, oh, we can now have a holiday inside China, perhaps more easily.
Yes, but still a lot of Chinese would take this opportunity to travel abroad. So that also means potentially it's good for the other countries where Chinese can travel to.
Do you have many people coming to your guest house who are Chinese? Is it more Chinese than foreigners?
On this national holidays, it's primarily Chinese.
And it's likely then to bring more money to the business.
Yes, because they have the longer holiday where they can travel to different parts.
What sort of places do Chinese people like to go on holiday inside China?
Wherever there is kind of very much talked about travel destination. For the past 1 year, it was Guizhou and Chongqing and also Xinjiang. So people will go there, will follow the crowd and go. But there are some people who want to avoid these very crowded holiday and they will go to less travel part, which can also offer a great experience.
But overall, the announcement of these new holidays will help the businesses that want to have Chinese tourists in China.
Yes. For example, my guest house.
Wei Wu there in Guilin. Now, 23andMe was a business phenomenon. 23andMe began in 2006 with a simple plan. Use DNA testing for individuals to show who you are, where you came from. Also, your potentially inherited health risks. It was hugely popular. It became a publicly traded company in 2021. Soon had a market capitalization of $6 billion. But it has fallen a long way. A series of data breaches, plus doubts cast on its privacy safeguards, also concerns about the scope and value of the tests themselves. It's all starkly reduced its value. Now it says it's going to cut 40% of its workforce, or 200 jobs, as it fights for survival. Let's talk about this with Sabela Ojea, who's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, joins us on the line from New York. Sabela, thanks for being with us. What is the situation right now at 23andMe? I mean, is it on the verge of collapse?
Hi, Roger. As of today, we don't really, we don't know if it's on the verge of collapse, but we've known that it's been close to losing its spot. It's a spot on Nasdaq, that it's got a lot of drama on its board, and that the CEO wants to take the company private because things aren't working out. The company, it's losing money and it needs a way out to its current situation.
So how did it all go so wrong? Because this was a hugely popular model, wasn't it? This idea of DNA testing for health, but also for genealogy.
I think that at first the company had a very clear idea about what it wanted to sell, which was like DNA test. But the CEO wanted the business to grow, and and she decided that drug testing, developing new drugs would be the way to grow the business, right? But the company went public in 2021 in order to gain more, in order to raise money to make this happen. But this is a very expensive business. Developing drugs, it can take years. It takes many years and a lot of money to develop them, drugs.
And I was going to say, and I suppose the awful thing is with the DNA testing, once someone has paid the money and taken the test, that's kind of what they want. They've got what they need, and there's a limit to how far you can go with that.
Exactly. So you only need to take one test to see what your ancestry, what your past has looked like, right? Your family past has looked like. And the company is now trying also to develop a subscription model to get recurring revenue, because that's the main problem of the business model. But that is growing very slowly too. So yesterday, the company said that they are no longer going to develop therapies under the company, and that they are either trying to, and that they will no longer develop them under 23andMe.
Yeah, so it's going to be a big change, and we'll see where the company goes. Sabella, thanks so much for being with us. Sabella Ajaya there with the Wall Street Journal in New York, talking about 23andMe and its problems. That's pretty much it from World Business Report for me and the rest of the team here in Salford. Bye-bye.